Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1012.DE0611, certificate number 42007. The push button.
I have no idea. This is either going to prove to be the most universal experience in the world to the point of mundanity, or it's going to make me sound like a huge weirdo. And I don't know which
it
is.
Why not both?
Let's figure it out. Let's figure
okay.
out. Mundanity or like...
or weird.
Crazy eccentricity. Did you as a child love to press buttons?
Absolutely. See, I would press a button.
Oh my gosh.
All you have to do is give me a button and I want to press it.
Like compare them to say dials, knobs,
I also like dials
switches,
and knobs.
But are buttons switch. Better?
They are pretty good.
I feel like I found buttons to be so much more satisfying than...
Well, now, wait a minute.
Knobs,
you just,
dials, and...
You just mimed pushing the Jeopardy button. Your version of pushing a button is to hold up a controller and press a button with your thumb.
Well, that's also a joystick of the kind that had the button on top.
Yeah, but what kind was...
You know, the old Atari 2600.
No, the 2600 had a button on the side.
It did, right? So, yeah. So there, it's that. But we also... Didn't you also have this kind with the button on top of the joystick?
I didn't because I had an Intellivision, as described many times CV.
We should have Intellivision sponsor this show. They get mentioned more than any existing company. We've mentioned them more than IBM.
And Intellivision, of course, had that disc that, if you really play aggressively, caused severe thumb damage.
But do you remember when the video game consoles had a little paddle component? Like that predated the joystick?
Yeah.
Like whatever was before the 2600, the Odyssey or the Magnavox or whatever, it had one of these paddles. And those just, there was no sense of fun.
No.
Something about this motion, rolling that way is not fun.
Right.
But clicking and pressing is fun.
Well, if you think about the way you played Defender or Asteroids, you had a joystick and a button on the console that you would push to fire. Do, do, do. And that was true for... What? All those things.
Yeah,
Missile Command.
In arcade games, yeah, it's true. The button was never on the joystick.
No, it was always on the... So you could rapid fire. And I don't remember... I mean, I think the button and the joystick were constant interfaces until I stopped playing console, until I stopped playing video games.
I mean, to this day, there's still... You know, now it's not a joystick. It's a little D-pad with a bunch of buttons.
Why?
Buttons are more central now.
Those things, those... Did you call it a D-pad?
Is that right? I think that's right.
The ones that modern gamers, and by modern gamers, I mean anybody under 40, those things, why do they look like Space Invaders invaders, right? The Space Invaders always had at least one Space Invader that actually looked like that controller, right?
The D-pad is the little directional thing with the four arrows, the cross-shaped thing that appears on the Space Invader-shaped.
And what is that controller called? It's called a controller.
Just a controller.
Right, the young people, but it's like somehow it became a universal design.
I think it's because it's got two hand grips.
Yeah, it looks like a steering wheel almost, like a Formula One steering wheel.
Yeah, it looks like a Tesla steering yoke.
Well, I like maybe to play my Tesla, games with a yoke.
Maybe the Tesla steering yoke was designed after the gaming.
I think that's probably true.
And that was designed after the shape of a space invader. The whole thing is. trying to acclimate us to UFOs.
The aliens want us.
They've already been here for decades, hey. and they're just like, hey, look.
They're like, stop using those weird square shaped things. We need normal blob shaped controls.
And you know why? Because a whole generation is used to holding those controllers, and the UFOs just want to be held. It's how you hug an UFO is to hold it with two hands.
They're coming here to be hugged.
Yeah, and they're just like, we have to get people used to
how to
hug us.
They don't want our nitrogen. They don't want to probe us.
No.
They just want hugs.
And the buttons are probably their erogenous zones. They're like, oh, you know, we just want to be held. And well, see, you're...
Poke my D-pad, baby.
That's what I'm saying. You're a revulsion reaction right there.
That's what they need to overcome.
They need to overcome it. Because if they just showed up in 1950 and been like, touch our buttons.
Touch our D-pads.
People would have freaked out.
Maybe repressed 50s Americans would have loved to touch their buttons.
Maybe, but I bet like 35-year-old gamers... If you introduced like kind of a furry, maybe slightly slimy little UFO into their lives and just said, hold it like a controller and then push its buttons, they'd be like, great.
It's true that if you're serious about aliens, you seem dedicated to the proposition that they do not have right angles, right?
Oh, right.
Think about alien tech. It's always round, yeah, organic.
Smooth, smoochy.
Like the end of Close Encounters.
Because it may...
Only the bad guys have, you know, military armadas with right angles like we do.
You think about 18th century tech, it was all still kind of carved from wood. And what made 19th century tech seem modern was that it was made out of industrial produced square
nickel or bronze
steel and just welded. And it was all sharp angles. And that's what our grandparents thought was modern.
But as we'll see, the very first push buttons were an attempt to make the rich think that buttons looked fancy and stylish.
What?
So like the first buttons you could buy were like shaped like a pear or something.
Oh, are you talking about buttons like on a shirt?
No, I'm talking about device buttons. I'm talking about interface.
They were shaped like a pear?
Yeah, like a fancy doorbell might be today, or a slightly old-fashioned looking. There was no attempt to scare people with, maybe it's because modernism had not been invented yet, and
was this like
an utilitarian right angle kind of Mies van der Rohe design didn't exist pre-Bauhaus?
You know, another thing we say on this show a lot is fin de siècle.
This is fin de siècle.
Was it a kind of Art Nouveau or pre Art Nouveau?
Yeah, we're
style?
We're situated in the late 19th century.
God, I love that stuff.
Until you pointed out that I was doing a thumb press instead of a index finger press,
yeah.
I had not made the connection that. What if my childhood love of buttons is what gave me my career?
I bet it was.
You know? But for me, it wasn't even video games. It was like anything with a button.
Yeah, me too.
Touchtone phone, a calculator.
But
man, do you remember your first calculator?
Oh, do I? Well, you know, on my first calculator watch, I didn't have a calculator watch, but in seventh grade, Kevin Horning got a calculator watch, yep. And it had a little game on it, right? What was that?
Oh,
that first,
did they come with a little game?
Yeah, there was some kind of little game that we would sit at the lunch table and just watch him play this little dot, move a dot around kind of game on his watch. And we just felt like, well, this is better than walking on the moon.
What could be better
than
this?
We are in the future. But I loved buttons, especially that you pushed in and it stayed in.
Ah, that's good.
And then you clicked it and it came back out.
It must be a very specific haptic or tactile thing. That we just do not, because it doesn't seem like it's learned.
Hmm. Oh, right.
I hate to speculate that it's sexual in any way. In fact, let's stay away from that entirely.
Click, click. I'm going to keep coming back to it because it really does feel like push it in and then it pops back out.
But there's really almost no romantic activity where you're hoping to click something in.
And it stays in.
And it stays in.
What are you talking about?
Of
romance.
Do your partners have presets?
Well, it's not just the physicality of it. It's like, I wish I could push a button and it would stay pushed in and things would work on their own.
It's almost just something
it's
about
like emotional.
The gentle feedback you're getting, you know, like it has a way it wants to be, which is not so true for a knob or a dial.
Well, you know, dials have, there's
that spring-loaded kind.
There's the tactile dials that go click, click, click.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the ones that are continuous motion. And the ones that are continuous motion are often that's a lie. It's really...
It is clicking?
Well, internally, and right. Then there are some that truly are on a kind of graph.
I mean, a lot of this is music equipment, right?
It is. Oh, this is such a huge thing.
The first time I played with a synthesizer, the pitch bend thing would bounce back, and that was my first time with a spring-loaded knob like that. And I thought that was almost as good as a button. Nothing's as good as a button, John, but...
Well, 70s stereo equipment, which, you know, that late 60s, early 70s hi-fi mania, all those receivers and amplifiers, they all had buttons, like incredibly, you could almost gauge how nice the stereo equipment was by
the number of buttons.
Well, and also how great the button felt, because you know what a cheap button feels like.
Yes.
And you know what a quality button feels like.
And what about the kind that light up when you press them? Oh man.
Well, that was the best thing about that opening scene in War Games, our first introduction to what it really looks like in a nuclear missile silo, where these two guys sitting deep in the earth at these enormous consoles of flashing buttons, and you're just like, give me those buttons. I don't know what they do, but let me push them.
The Enterprise had flashing buttons too. I mean, it wasn't clear which ones were readouts and which ones you could press. And when I say you, I mean Uhura. Sulu. Yeah, Sulu. Uh-huh. In the situation, you are Sulu or Uhura.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing that a lot of my button fixation as a kid is more of a futurism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like wanting to live in a society that has Millennium Falcon-like arrays of buttons.
And that you would know what they all did and be able to control them. It seemed like adulthood.
That's true. But remember how, like, even then, you know, you would see pictures of an Apollo capsule, you know, a lunar module or something. Guess what? No buttons.
No, they didn't want those guys pushing buttons.
And I think you can see why. You want a switch that's either on or off. You can't really, it's hard to lean on. So you get lights and buttons.
Which is what made the space shuttle seem so cool, because suddenly the buttons were back. The whole cockpit of a space shuttle is just buttons, buttons, buttons.
There is an abort button in most Apollo-era capsules. That's the only button is abort, which I guess means you want it to be a game show scenario where, bam, you know, you can get your palm on that thing ASAP, right?
Yeah, right.
But, it seemed like that would be next generation when spaceships had buttons instead of just lights and switches. And we actually had, this is a weird memory I'm having for the first time in 30 years. For some reason, my dad, you know, wandering around the junk markets of Seoul, Korea, had brought, he was always bringing home weird vinyl, and he brought home a special, like a sound effects record.
Yes.
That had a lot of kind of space age, you know, the tracks were called like Escape to Hyperspace or Entering Orbit or whatever.
It was
whatever.
All done with a theremin.
It was, well, there was no Brian Eno music. It was just like a lot of like tap, 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 click, click, you know, like the kind of noises you would make to yourself as a kid if you were playing Rocket Ranger.
And you listen to it over and over at night on headphones?
Well, I remember part of it was, you know, the astronaut is like...
Yeah.
And he's got like a keyboard. And I was like, holy cow, now that would be next generation if you had like basically an Apple II Plus instead of the switches that Buzz Aldrin is clicking or the whatever the throttle that Harrison Ford is pulling, you know, kind of the 50s hot rod mode. And I just thought, well, that's going to be the future. Buttons everywhere.
Well, if you think about Buzz Aldrin, that was that moment in all of our lives where he was like, this is programmed to land here, but I'm going to override the program.
Yes.
Because this is, you know, like, I am in charge of the capsule. And it was like, oh, my God, he's flying it.
Did people know that at the time? I feel
know.
Like that was only like 80s, 90s revisionism for me was hearing how kind of fraught the Apollo 11 landing
They're
was.
Out of gas, and it's just like, here we come. I also had a home organ.
Like a Hammond or a...
Yeah, the Wurlitzer.
B2.
But it was an organ, you know, not even a prosumer. It was just a consumer organ, not any kind of thing you would take and play in a club. It was made out of particle board.
We did too.
Yeah.
What percentage of houses had like a cheap organ?
Everybody.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they all had
we need a show about this. What happened to organ culture?
They all had a little salsa, you know, sort of drum machine, like poop. And then they had a not just the piano keys, but also kind of accordion keys that would play chords.
Right.
Is this true of yours too?
I think so.
And then it had those sort of paddle... They weren't buttons, they were switches on off, but they were kind of circular tipped paddles that you would engage for different tones effects, and settings.
Like the equivalent of stops on a pipe organ?
Yeah, sort of, but you know, made out of, and I remember just playing with the buttons even more than with the keyboard.
We weren't allowed to turn ours on.
Oh, really?
So I would just go play with the buttons.
You would turn them on and they would have that, the fan would come on. And zzz. We actually used those in the early Long Winters records because the whole aesthetic of our indie rock was, let's take the home crapola and repurpose these toy instruments as real instruments.
It's
and
punk, but we're not tough.
Exactly.
It's punk, but we don't want to get piercings.
We don't want to get piercings. We're not about the downfall of civilization.
But we are about our own childhoods.
We're exactly about our own childhoods, and there's a way to communicate that loneliness and sadness of being left alone at home.
If you're mad about that, you form a punk band.
Right.
But if you're wistful about it,
yeah, right.
You become an indie rocker.
And I think a lot of it is you weren't allowed to touch it, but they left you home alone all day. And so
your house is full of things you can't go through.
Yeah, that forbidden stuff. I wasn't allowed to light matches in the fireplace, but it doesn't mean I didn't.
I mean, there's a Freudian take here to you having a whole childhood where you were forbidden to touch your own organ.
You said we weren't going to do sex stuff, and then you come back.
I guess I meant that I didn't want you to do it.
Oh, yeah. I know. It makes everybody uncomfortable.
It's charming when I do it.
Because I have that...
It's playing against type.
I have that Venus flytrap radio voice that makes people... It's already like a dry seat in the house.
and we're only talking about like Wurlitzers. Yeah. The future was... That idea we had that buttons were the future was, spoilers, correct. Buttons are ubiquitous. Today, you just made coffee. Did you press a button?
I did, a giant button. The coffee maker upstairs has, because there is a culture now, and this is true in music too, of giant knob, giant button. And it's actually a baloney culture. I don't like it because—
It's the abort button.
Well, yeah, and what they've done is they've digitized everything, and it's like, oh, you don't want seven buttons. You want one giant button that you can program to be any one of 14 buttons.
No.
And it's like, I don't. I want a button.
I want a panel of buttons.
I want a dedicated button for each task. So like here—
I want to feel like a 50s switchboard operator.
On my little guy here, that the little digital interface that that we're using to record the show, I have, what, four knobs, three switches, and two buttons, and there's nothing digital about it. Oh, I mean, it is a digital converter, but there's no menus.
Right.
There's, you know, I can't control it from, I mean, I suppose there's probably
It is shocking how small, I have a remote control for my, you know, TV and receiver that has a little screen that lets me scroll through and program things.
Yeah.
And this is like a handheld $50 thing. And it's now a complex choose your own adventure book. And I also don't want that. I pressed a button to start my car today. I pressed a button to get water out of the fridge. It's just buttons all the way down.
Yeah, right. Do you have a nervous button tick? Because I do.
Like what button is available to you to...
No, if I'm in front of a console of buttons, but not at this moment required to push a button, I will tap out a little...
What's the pattern?
Where each finger has its own button, and I'm doing a little... It's too gentle to actually press the button. I figure out what the amount of pressure it is necessary to activate the button. And then I use less pressure as a kind of nervous... Ticket, ticket, ticket. You know, kind of here's me on the keyboard. I'm not actually typing anything, but I'll sit because I just want buttons under my fingers, and it drives some people crazy. They're like, "What are you doing? What are you typing? Why are you messing with the television remote?" And I'm like, "I just want to feel the buttons, and I'm ready to push them, but I'm not going to. I just want them under my finger."
Does everyone have these little nervous finger things they do? Little patterns they draw, little rhythmic tapping patterns? I sure do. I'm not going to list them all because they will make me sound mentally ill. But if we were open about a bunch of these, like a bunch of kind of...
We're going to normalize it.
Yeah, exactly. A bunch of spectrum-y people will be like, hey, everybody does this.
Well, I don't think everybody does it because when I do it, for instance, if I'm watching TV with a group of people, the fact that I am monkeying with the remote
drives everyone nuts.
Really does. They're like, what? Why are you playing with the remote? And I'm like, I'm not. I just, my fingers are very happy to have the remote in my hands and the buttons under my finger.
I like pressing buttons so much that I will be the guy poking at an elevator or crosswalk button. Even though I'm not impatient, I'm well aware it doesn't do anything.
Really?
But it's just like, there's a free button here to press, guys.
So you, when you're in an elevator and you want the door to close, you sit and tap the closed door button?
I'll tap the elevator call button. I don't give a damn. The other day I was crossing, somewhere by the convention center, Pike and 8th, somewhere over downtown. And I'm waiting for a crosswalk button. So I'm kind of tapping the crosswalk button. And some guy comes up to me and he does not immediately strike me as like kind of,
guy.
Unhoused street person, who knows what's going to happen, it just seems like a guy in my peripheral vision. And he's like, that doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah.
And right. I was just kind of like, oh yeah, minimal response. Oh yeah. Cause we're in Seattle. I don't want to have a conversation.
Sure. Of course not.
And the guy immediately is like, then why the F do you keep pressing that effing button? And I look over and I'm like, oh, maybe this guy's going through some stuff that I didn't realize. Cause he just launches into this tirade about how the crosswalk buttons don't actually do anything. And so
what the hell are you doing?
Get yourself together, you effing, and I was like, hey, are you from here? That's not like a super Seattle kind of a vibe, but I think about that now every time I nervously hit a crosswalk button.
Well, it's funny because if I were at a crosswalk and a guy came up and started pressing the button over and over, I'm not sure if I would like it either.
Well, I don't think I would like it either because I'm like, who is this type A weirdo? It'll change when it changes.
Right.
But I'm not trying to make the light change.
You're just tapping,
got something going on.
Right. Okay. Well,
I'm just Gene Kelly over here. I could scat, but that would be more annoying, not less.
I want more buttons. And I feel now that you've brought it up that that I'm being deprived of buttons.
They're going virtual now. A touch screen is just buttons, all the motion of buttons without any of the fun.
Do you remember when they took the button off the bottom of the iPhone?
Yeah, now they have haptics.
Devastated.
But guess what I have?
Oh, look at you.
I have not upgraded just because.
Wait, have a button phone.
I do. You can still get this.
I miss my button.
It's a little smaller too, which I like.
Yeah.
I like being able to thumb the whole screen.
You know, when I was in that relationship with Millennium Girlfriend, she's a younger person, a millennium, and she had this tech culture energy. And she was like, small phone with a button. The smaller, the better is what cool tech people have.
I didn't know.
And I intentionally got the large type phone and made the type much larger than I needed it to be just to antagonize her. She was always like, God, your phone is so embarrassing.
I can't believe you guys aren't still together.
And I was like, what do you mean? And I would look over the top of my glasses, even though that made it harder to see.
Well, buttons were not always ubiquitous. The button had to be invented. And it kind of seems, I'm sure there's, I'm a little worried there's like 99% invisibles about this.
Oh, it could be.
Probably.
Those guys are nice.
They're lovely. I love that show.
Yeah.
But I feel like I may not be treading new ground here, but I did find the expert in the field. In 2012, a PhD candidate at Northwestern named Rachel Plotnick published the first of what turned out to be a lot of work about the dawn of buttons and button culture. Mm-hmm. She later expanded it into a book. And I feel like, thanks to Rachel Plotnick, I am now a near expert.
Wow.
Spending 45 minutes with her work has made me into, I got to be top 100.
Sure.
I don't know who all read her PhD dissertation, but
when you do something like that, do you then look her up and see what her career has? Because when I read somebody's academic paper, I'm always like, I wonder if they're now the professor of button technology at DePaul University.
I was honestly a little bummed to see that she'd expanded into a book because it meant that all my tracking down the academic journal no longer made me special because I could have just gone to Amazon or conceivably Barnes & Noble.
If publish or perish, Ken.
The word button, it's the same word we use for a clothing button, as you've indicated.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different use. And in fact, our use is more derived from the French bouton.
Bouton.
Which is the word they use for a button on a blouse, don't get me wrong. But to them, it's a more general word for basically a bump.
Oh.
Any kind of pimple or protrusion.
If you have a mole, it's called a bouton.
I bet they have a different word for those. But yeah, I think it's not wrong to say that a bump is a bouton.
Do the British call like clothing buttons like snap-tastics or something? Some British word like fanoodles?
Yeah, I'm sure in Australia they're like fangle-wangles. Or... No, but the British say buttons.
But do they say buttons for the shirt thing and for the controller thing?
I believe so.
I mean, you never know with that.
I mean, the thing about tech words is once English speakers start saying buttons, then like in the rest of the world, it's like, usei el button para, you know.
Exactly.
It'll be like, el operating system no está funcionando.
But the Germans feel like exactly, they play a major role here.
I'm sure in Germany, it's still a
Kleinfixer.
A presser disc or something.
And the Danes, you know, the Danes are going to have like a seven.
Even more so.
Yeah, like two hyphens and a.
They're like German, but like the Scandinavian languages are like German, but they only have like, what, nine words tops to
work
with?
But they combine them in different
words. Nine Viking era words. Like that's why it's Bluetooth.
Yeah.
They had words for blue and tooth and not that many more words.
So they just call them the clitoris.
No, they don't.
It's spelled with a K.
That's awful.
I know.
I'm picturing it now. Just the word is very upsetting to me.
It is. Or a Latin ending.
Like U.S.? Oh, no. That's even worse. The origins of button interface technology, Plotnik tells us, lie oddly not with clothing, not with any kind of, really not with any machine. Well, I guess it is a machine, and you kind of alluded to this with your Wurlitzer. It goes back to musical instruments.
Ah, of course.
Those were the oldest things that had a thing for your finger to go, bup, bup, bup.
The clarinet.
A trumpet has those keys. Valves. You push down. And, you know, going back to the 16th century, the spinet piano was a, push your finger down on it. I mean, it's not round, but it's a
lever.
It's a lever you push down on, and that makes the action happen in the machinery, which was not true of a crossbow or a sextant or a loom or,
right,
you know, that, so the.
This feels like a Leonardo da Vinci thing almost. Isn't it the type of thing that he would, there'd be some sketchbook where he was like, and then the typewriter.
I almost feel like nobody in, like even the early typewriters did not have the front facing keyboard. Like we think of that as intuitively obvious. Okay, the interface will be buttons in some way. But that all had to be like
decided upon. It's a thought technology. I love this.
It really is.
It didn't exist and then it did.
And I think from musical instruments, the avenue then goes through the Morse key, the telegraph. You know, in 1844, just a year or two after the invention of the telegraph, it's decided that the interface is going to be the finger hitting a thing down. Because early machine, you know, there are scattered early button-like things on machines that were not electric, you know, that are just levers or springs somehow that translate directly into device action. But electricity is what changes the game, because then what you're trying to do is complete a circuit.
Right.
And for completing a circuit, really nothing better than pushing one thing into something else. That's
right.
That's the basic movement. It's not a knob. It's not a dial. It's not going to be any kind of lever, really.
Ones and zeros. On, off.
Yeah. The most direct way to get on, off is like, is this touching? Then it's on. Is it not touching? Then it's off. And so...
Unless on is not touching and off is touching.
Like a dead man's abort switch, like Buzz Aldrin has to keep his palm on the abort switch the whole time or the engines turn off.
Exactly.
Neo, my elbow's getting a little stiff. You better keep pressing that, you moron.
But there are situations where really the machine being on means that these are all
true.
The button itself is a kill switch.
There are so many variants in button technology which you would not consider. You know, we consider the button just having been delivered fully formed from Mount Sinai and every machine at once, and that is not true. Like, there were hundreds of patents filed in the late 19th century, applications for different improvements to the button. You know, how do you get the right feel? What's it going to be made out of? What makes it durable? How do you keep it from overheating if somebody presses it too much? And you got to invent a regulator that keeps the button from overheating if somebody presses it too much, because electrical components are pretty basic.
Yeah, right.
Back then, 150 years ago.
The button that has a clear plastic button surface, and when you push it in, there's a piece of red plastic behind it that says, now I'm red, and so I'm on. It's not even electrical.
It doesn't have the light yet.
It's turned red.
I'm a different color.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
And, you know, exactly, like, is it a button that sticks down? Is it a button that when you push it down, pops up a different button?
Yeah.
Like, all this takes decades to come together, and it does so weirdly across so many fields. Like, it seems to be directed at the rich first.
Really?
Like, button technology trickles downward. Because really, if you're a working man, you know, if you're working the soil, if you're digging a ditch,
yeah, you don't need
your shovel doesn't need a button. It's all for the idle person who is like, well, what can I do with an electrical signal? Well, I could ring a bell, you know.
Right.
So you get a lot of this, the buzzer that tells you someone's at your front door, or in more cases, summons the person who will do the actual work.
So if someone is working at this period, an industrial device, like, I guess I'm thinking, okay, a locomotive is going to have, like a steam locomotive is going to have levers, plenty of levers, right. But they're all mechanical. There's nothing electrical. What's the first electrical controller for an industrial machine?
I mean, a lot of it starts out being professionals, but like not in an industrial setting. Like in 1888, the first Kodak camera has a button on the side, and that's what opens the shutter. In 1891, the first typewriter has keys that face the typist instead of being a weird ball-shaped thing that I can't even. In 1887, the first, elevator operators were still a thing well into the 20th century, but this is also for the rich because it would be in a small setting where there's not enough use to require an elevator operator. You want to have a way to, you know, instead of I'm going to pull the thing and the elevator starts, I'll push it back and the elevator stops. You actually want an electrical way to say elevator come, elevator go to the other floor.
Right.
And that's 1887. So flashlight, 1911. But the idea that somebody in a steel mill or later an automobile factory, like that's probably a very late, you know, I think then you're still doing the motions that do the thing. You're turning the wrench that tightens the widget, you know?
Yeah. But eventually there's equipment that first probably has an on off, but then eventually will have like, now I'm going to do this process. Now I'm going to do that process. Incredible to me that the elevator was an early button implementation.
The first elevator buttons are ahead of the first camera buttons, typewriter keys, flashlight buttons, car dashboard buttons.
Because you can still, when you travel, you can still interact with these 19th century elevators because there are a lot of them still out there.
Little cages
with a kind of Bakelite or pre-Bakelite button. It's still very satisfying to push that kind of button and to think that's like
140 years old almost.
Well, that, but also prior to that, I mean, that would have been the first button many people encountered.
Yeah, you'd have to teach someone how to use that.
Right.
Well, what if I press this? And people were scared of electricity. You know, famously when they electrified the White House in 1891, Benjamin and Caroline Harrison refused to use the light switches.
Well, it's because Tesla kept electrocuting elephants or whatever. It wasn't Tesla.
Edison would sneak in at night, electrocute the elephants, and then sneak out, and he would plant like Croatian food, crumbs of a flatbread on the ground, and everybody would be like, oh, that was Tesla.
Well, you know what? I have, when I was fixing up my house, I bought an old house that hadn't been repaired since it was built in 1952. And one of the things I wanted was a bathtub that made bubbles because I like to sit in a bath a lot. I take long baths, and at various times I want there to be bubbles.
I haven't taken a bath in 20 years.
I know. And nobody in this house likes baths either. My mom was like, take this bath out of my house and put a shower in. Everybody loves these showers. And when I show up at a hotel and there's not a bathtub, I immediately call the front desk and I say, how dare you? Plus, this room smells like cigars. But I was like, I'm a big man. I want a big bathtub and I want it to have bubbles. And in the course of looking for bubbles, I found a bathtub which had just been discontinued for reasons that may be clear.
All the electrocutions.
That had two kinds of bubbles. It had the jacuzzi bubbles, and then it had some sort of down below, down at the bottom, some sort of effervescent bubbles.
Oh.
And you could have both kinds of bubbles on at the same time, an effervescence coming up from below.
Do you think it's just a smaller jet?
It's like a tiny little bubbles, but it's made up through a different process. The jacuzzi bubbles.
It's not chemical, right? You're not sticking Alka-Seltzer in the bottom of your bathtub.
No, but like the jacuzzi, we all know there's a little filter down at the bottom. It pulls water in and then it shoots it back out. Mm-hmm. Whereas the effervescent bubbles are coming from not within the tub. They're coming from some sort of
extra dimensional choice.
Yeah, that's right. A bubble maker that's somewhere else. And so what I like to
do
is
alien tech.
Sometimes I have the effervescent bubbles on. Sometimes I have the jacuzzi bubbles on. But the effervescent bubbles are controlled with their own controller, which has those, it has one of those plastic covers, and you kind of press a button.
You press a dimple.
A dimple.
Yeah.
You press
I don't love those.
Like a pimple. I don't like them either because because the tactile is just sort of like, this is like a blister in a,
yeah.
And then the jacuzzi has a big button. Well, the other day, the jacuzzi button stopped working. And I'm in the bathtub, and I'm pressing the jacuzzi button.
This is like the worst thing that's ever happened to you.
I'm like, what? How do I? And so I'm sitting there, and I'm monkeying with it. And then at a certain point, I'm monkeying with it, and I'm like, wait a minute. This is an electrical circuit, a button, that is not working. And so I'm sitting in a tub full of water with my wet thumb, you know, pressing this button over and over. At what point is this, am I creating a hazard? And then I stopped pressing it. And now I sit in the bathtub only with the effervescent bubbles.
Sadly,
thinking, here's another freaking task that I have to hire somebody or get out some manual and buy a special tool.
You're the Benjamin Harrison of bathing.
I'm so mad about it. But anyway, this button, it's now my button noir. And I'm slightly afraid of it, right? It's like,
we have a recliner. We have like a recliner love seat in front of our TV, and it's actually got buttons. Button to make you go back, button to make you go forward. I love it.
For those of you wondering whether or not this show is compatible with Marxism, my button bathtub and Ken's button recliner.
The poor have those lever
Lazy
boys where you have to push back like a peon. I'm not going to push backwards.
I spent the night in the hospital a couple of days ago, and there was a giant chair on wheels that was there just for the dads, I think.
Yeah.
And it folded all the way back into a bed.
With a button?
It had levers. It was entirely manual, no buttons.
You know why? Because they'll last longer.
Yeah.
The buttons are going to die. And this is what happened. So the other seat next to me does not have buttons. It has even worse, those just metal pads where your finger becomes the button. Like your own electrolytes complete the circuit. I don't like that interface.
No, I don't either.
You always kind of, maybe it's just my imagination, but I feel like I can feel the electrons and I don't want that.
No.
For your bathtub reasons.
Yeah.
And that one stopped working. And so every time Mindy's trying to get that up, she's like got all these ways to game that little metal surface to try to make it work. And I don't know who to call. It's like your bathtub. Who am I going to call to like look at a weird button on a lazy boy?
For those of you who are screaming first world problems into your earphones.
Oh, only one kind of jetted tub works, John.
All I have to say is no duh. Yes. Well, make a list of your first world problems.
We will stipulate that these are not very serious problems. So even though, these are devices for the rich in the early days of buttonry because it's a gadgeteer's thing. You know, a catalog will be like, you could hang this by your bed and then when you press this button,
servants will come running.
I mean, there's a lot of that, you know, but it later becomes more advanced. Like this could control your clock. This could control your lights. Even before there's electric lights in houses, a lot of the gaslit houses are like, buy some of these buttons, you know, and then you could be at the other end of the hall and press the button and, you know, the lights will turn on in the kitchen.
You see this a lot in old houses, including mine. When I first moved in, he had the man that built it was an electrical engineer. And he had installed a series of low voltage buttons all around the house, controlling all manner of things. And when I had a new electrician come in, they were absolutely baffled because in the walls there were little transformers that bounced the electricity down to some low voltage wiring, and they were like, "What is going on here? He salvaged all this from Boeing or something." I was like, "Yeah, he did."
I like I've looked at houses before where you can tell somebody put in some weird little homemade intercoms. Doesn't this have? Yeah, this house has one.
Yeah,
you know,
we have buttons over there.
Just
on
weird,
the wall.
Weird old mid-century buttons on the wall of your
Mom!
House.
Mom, Mom!
To do
Mom,
some house only.
I'm downstairs.
And this was a bit, I don't think we really understand how big an impediment to life darkness was. Yeah. In a world before widespread gas and electric lighting. Like, the early Edison ads for this stuff say,
you can stay up past 7.
Exactly. No stumbling over furniture. No breaking of bric-a-brac. You know, no more will a black cat or a coal bin, you know, interrupt your walk down your hallway. Light. Light at a touch and plenty of it.
Well, their houses were full of bric-a-brac, which is not
too much bric-a-brac.
Problem.
And more coal than we had.
Right.
And probably more black cats, honestly, because they didn't spay or neuter them. But, you know, this idea that you would have at a touch is, I think, the important part of that ad, because this is what everyone starts selling. You know, soon electrical catalogs are full of just dozens of different kinds of button-driven gadgets.
Well, think of what a pain in the neck it was to light a gas lamp or even a candle, especially before safety matches.
Yeah.
Like to get up and be like, you know, I'm going to the bathroom, but I don't need to do all that just to get the light to keep me from stumbling over bric-a-brac and black cats. I'm just going to feel my way to the bathroom. Whereas an electric light, you turn them on for no reason at all.
That's when dads start to have to turn them off, when your job becomes turning off lights. It's the equivalent of those 50s and 60s Good Housekeeping ads where it's like the modern woman, just at the touch of a button, her dishes are clean. Mm-hmm. At the touch of a button, her leftovers are gone.
Little did they know.
It's almost like they're giving you wish fulfillment. You know, Kodak says, you press the button, we do the rest.
Yeah,
and of course, this is the age of labor saving and efficiency. And this really resonates with America and Europe.
Here's George Jetson.
Well, it's funny. Like the Jetson, do you remember this part of the premise of the Jetsons, which is that he pushes buttons for a job?
Yeah.
Because it became like, you know, two things happen. One, this becomes an amazing symbol of hope and, you know, almost like genie in a lamp wish fulfillment, you mm-hmm. know, you will press the button and unseen forces will grant your wishes and make your life easier. But then it becomes the ominous, like, well, how is this going to change us? If everything is available at the push of a button, does this violate the Protestant work ethic?
Well, and also post-war, the bomb was always described
I mean,
it was graphically depicted as a button, always depicted as a button.
And I think that continues to this day. Do you remember when Trump would tweet like, my nuclear button is much bigger and fancier than Kim Jong-un's from his famine-ridden country? You know, like,
what we need is a fancy big button.
The funny thing is there is no button, and Trump is bragging about how ours is nicer than North Korea's.
That checks out.
As early as the 50s, I've seen this Korean War cartoon where, you know, some Bill Moyers type is shaking his head sadly that nowadays we have push-button war, but we don't have push-button peace. You know,
wow.
Like, where is the button that will bring peace?
You know what that is? A great tweet. That would get retweeted a lot. Are you going to tweet it right now?
Bill Moyers, come back.
Do it.
I said Bill Moyers, but I think I'm thinking
that's
of
later.
I'm Bill thinking Moyers of Bill Malden later. And Bill Moyers, and I'm combining them into one American conscience figure.
Well, you could throw Carl Malden in there, and then you'd have a real
an American Express card. Yeah, so there start to be these fears, and this leads to this Jetson trope where George Jetson goes to work and just presses a button a few times a day.
Right.
Whereas meanwhile at home, Jane, his wife, is getting push button finger. That this is her repetitive stress injury. There's an episode where she gets push button finger because I had to press the maid button, you know, 18 times today, George.
Well, you think carpal tunnel syndrome was a. Well, I mean, I guess it's still a thing, but do you remember when it was really in the headlines all the time?
I do.
Maybe that's a good omnibus
episode. I'm just I think about it more because I was in tech and I was like,
did you have
this? Is my future? No, but everybody, all the older guys I knew did.
Repetitive stress injuries.
I was like, how do I avoid this? So these two strains are the stories of buttons for the next 50 years. You know, you've got the utopian symbol of buttons as a brighter and more convenient world. And then all the worried moralists. Hey, a raccoon is walking right by your neighbor's
house.
You're
kidding. Let me see this.
It's a chonky raccoon. Look at this.
Oh, hey. And its tail has been truncated.
Yeah, what happened there? Did it get run over?
What are you doing out in the middle of the day, you ding dong?
It looks like it's drinking from that flower pot.
It is drinking from a flower pot. Well, you know.
This is not great in an audio format.
One reason that raccoon has a half a tail is that it's a daytime raccoon. And that is not...
He should be in a bush. He should be in a thicket somewhere.
Well, that is kind of a bushy neighbor's backyard. I one time encountered a raccoon in the middle of the day. I was walking down an alley, and it was coming the other way down the alley. And I realized it was blind. It had cataracts to the almost to the sense that, or almost to the degree that its eyes were white. And he was coming toward me, and I was walking toward him. And at a certain point, he realized I was there using his heightened senses. And then we had a little moment where I had to talk to him. I was like, "Hey, it's me. I'm here.
Get out of my way."
Well, no, I was like, "I am no threat to you, my friend." And he was very, obviously very freaked out. And he found a fence and went over it. But I still think about it. Like, how does a blind raccoon survive? How do you survive as an old raccoon? How do you get that far and stay alive? I guess it's because raccoons don't really have predators, but they, I mean, how does he keep out of trouble? I could have been some kind of raccoon predator.
In my experience, sighted raccoons do not back down from humans and jump over a fence.
He didn't back down either.
Well, but he got out of Dodge.
He did. He
didn't get up on his hind legs and go, which is what a lot of sighted raccoons will do.
A little bit. We had a moment where I was like, look, I mean, because if he had been like friendly or scared, I would have reacted differently. But I was like, I'm chill. You're chill. It was me, really, that adopted a peaceful tone.
I'm just wondering if maybe the fact that he is not a sighted raccoon is what's preserved him for so long, because he knows he's the rare raccoon that knows that discretion is the better part of valor, and
you
can't always be starting fights.
Right. Raccoons fight with each other a lot.
Hmm. What if the rest of the show is just about raccoons with no explanation? And then at the end we're like, and that concludes raccoons. So, sorry about the interruption.
No, that was great. I was glad to see
that. That was very eventful, but maybe not such good podcasting. It's not really an audio thing, a raccoon walking by.
I think most people who listen to this program have experience with washing bears, and they could picture a washing bear with half a tail in the bushes, and they were right there with us.
It is a good, it's a good omen, right? Yeah. For an omnibus. If a washing bear appears in the middle of it, it'll bless the rest of our journey.
I think. Trash panda.
So, like, on the utopian side of buttons, this always will go back to the 1893 World's Fair, like every omnibus does.
And, you know, my great-grandmother appeared at the World's Fair.
Was she a sexy fan dancer?
She was a singer. She sang some operetta and won a silver medal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Listen, I'm an old-time American.
Sorry for the implication that she was a burlesque artist.
No, not – well, you know, we're much – more lofty people, but I'm sure there was sexiness in her
operetta,
in her bustle, her ankle length.
The operetta
bustled.
Has always been the least sexy art form. No, the ads for the fair would have all kinds of promises of the delight, the button driven delights you would see there. You know, like, go to the German pavilion, press a button, and a Fraulein. You know, like, you know, I think there would be actual kind of sideshow. Little shows that would be button driven. You know, the Fraulein will yodel if you press the button. Over in the French one, the waiter will extend a baguette at the mere touch of a button.
Right.
And on the train on the way there, you know, the buttons you could press for service were a sign of luxury and modernity. But this is when people start to worry. I think a lot of it is driven by industry worrying that they're making buttons seem too easy. And therefore, they will not be able to charge consumers large amounts for it.
People were already worried about buttons before the turn of the century?
Yeah, there's button pushback very early. And some of it is coming from educators, and I'll get to that in a second. But a lot of it is just coming from the electrical industry, who wants you to know, hey, incredibly complicated things are happening when you press that button. And therefore, when you get your bill...
That's why.
Yeah, you should not think. But you said the button made life easy. So they would literally... put out pamphlets and ads called Think of the Wiring, where they would remind you how complicated and fancy electrical work and utilities were. They released a 1920 film called Back of the Button, under the theory that, quote, a comprehension of the billions that must be invested and of the army of workers who must toil in order that when they press a button, you know, like, you know, the stuff only works because of our huge... mammoth infrastructure.
They're reminding people that it's a first world problem, even then.
And then you have educators who start to worry. There's a woman named Dorothy Canfield Fisher, I think the first woman to bring Montessori to America. So, yep. You know, cheers or boos, depending on what you think of that.
Who could boo Montessori?
And a friend of Willa Cather, real social activist, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt loved her, but she was very worried about the, you know, what this would do to our kids, you know.
Oh, this is such a Montessori story.
It is, right? And it's also just the story of every technology, you know, like no matter how benign we now think the tech is, including pressing a button, there was someone to say, now, hold on.
Hold on.
If we start to raise our kids thinking that, you know, buttons are magic, they won't understand how devices work, you know? Back in the day, you would know how your crossbow or your sextant or your loom worked because it was clear that the motion you were doing was, and now we've totally, for the first time, divorced user motion from the purpose of the device, and this is just going to break our brains.
If I think of my daughter's Montessori education, which she, she pursued, or rather was forced to pursue until sixth grade, all the way through sixth grade, I don't think there was a button in the entire school.
Do you think it's still banned?
Well, no, I just, you're absolutely right. It's the whole premise is that you understand things by manipulating them with your hands and by seeing the process all the way through. And there's very little electricity, or maybe no electricity. It's all done with, you know, with.
That's why schools meet in the daytime. It would be too dark otherwise.
So, I think buttons didn't play any role in her education, less than even mine.
It led to a real educational revolution around this time where grades 6 through 8 really started to emphasize how does electricity work?
Yeah.
People would build simple circuits. So, you know, it would, and maybe this is what you and I are seeing the downline of this, a world where kids think buttons are cool and fun because this was the first time that kids were encouraged. You know, you can build a button with just two little plates of iron or nickel or anything. And so it was a very simple exercise to have kids build a little button that would complete a circuit and turn on a light or make a bell ring. Or yeah, we were still doing this in the 20th century.
Yeah, my friends Peter and Thomas Kluge, their father, and predictably Germans, they would their father would bring home old radios and anything that, you know, that plugged in, and they would take them apart and rebuild them into other things. It seemed like magic.
I mean, this started in the 1890s, just trying to turn particularly young boys, but also there was an offshoot of, well, the girls are going to need this for their domestic sciences in the modern household. They need to know how light switches work. So it was for everybody to, you know, take an hour and build a burglar alarm. And this was an important part of middle school aged education, just because people were scared of this idea of what if we turn devices into a black box? And of course, they were not wrong. That's exactly what ended up happening. Every device we now rely on is a thing we can't fix and don't really understand what's happening.
Yeah.
Our manipulation of it is kind of an illusion that has little to do with what the device actually performs.
It's a series of tubes.
Whole series of tubes inside your iPhone. But I mean, the genius of it is a black box allows for so much more complexity. You know, if every end user has to understand every stage of what every machine is doing, you never get a good machine because that's just that's too big an ask.
Maybe UFOs are actually shaped like iPhones and they've been just training us over and over, and now we're going to, maybe these actually are UFOs.
The iPhone is the combination of the right angles with the curved curves. Alien, the curved Close Encounters edges. So we're now living in the age of buttons. The battle for what is this going to do to our children was lost, as it so often is.
Do you remember, we've talked about this before, but I think the answer was no, but do you remember that installation at SeaTac Airport where it was a giant console of little red buttons?
We did talk about this.
And you did or didn't remember it?
I had not, it was like a repressed memory. I had not thought about it for 40 years. Yeah. When you mentioned that.
It was, you know.
But people sent us photos once we mentioned it on Omnibus.
Yeah, and it was just buttons. And there was no sense of what they did. And we would go stand there and press these buttons for hours and not have any. And the screen itself showed very little response to the buttons, but it felt like you were doing something because it was there.
One of our correspondents said you had to turn it into a mode where it would respond to the buttons, but it was not really. Usually it would just be in demo mode. And so that's why we thought we were accomplishing little.
Right, demo mode.
I would do the same thing with my, you know, calculators before I was old enough to know what the logarithm button meant. You know, I would just be like pressing buttons and, oh, right. This made a bigger number appear. Oh, this one made a smaller number appear. What if I do this one after the other one? What's the difference between C and CE? I think there has been some attempt to bring back buttons in a world of touchscreens. You know, yeah. I remember people complaining that the Tesla was all touchscreens and there was a lot of backlash. Other EV manufacturers tried to make sure they actually had knobs and switches and buttons because, you know, when you're driving, you don't want to kind of blindly clutch at a touchscreen.
In audio equipment, it's very true. There was, you know, the heyday of LCD screens and multiple menus to, you know, increase the amount of reverb on a thing. It's so not what you want. That now high-end audio gear all is back to knobs and buttons.
And is that largely the same reason? You want to be able to know you've pressed it immediately and always press it unfailingly quickly?
I feel like when you're interacting with an equalizer or a compressor or anything that produces a change in sound, even if it's all digital behind the thing, you really want to be interacting with a knob, and you don't want to have to go through a menu and find the value and change it with up down buttons. Like, it just, nobody liked it. Even if it had all these possibilities, it feels like in a way we're maybe living in a time where you realize, oh, unlimited possibilities is actually bad for creativity. And what helps creativity is a limited number of possibilities. And maybe if you're somebody that can understand the difference between 125 milliseconds and 126 milliseconds, there is stuff for you. But don't include that in you know, most pro or prosumer gear.
Everything got buttonized in the 20th century. 1938 had the first, you know, what we would think of as the equivalent of a save button, which was a radio button that could remember your preset station, the ancestor of every button in a video game or word processor. 1960, the first blender where you would hit the button. Uh-huh. I think a wearing miracle mixer. 1964, Ma Bell started to switch people over from dials to touch tone phones.
No, it was as early as 64 because we had dial phones into the 80s.
Well, Mindy, I was talking to Mindy about this last night. She remembers being sad in the 80s. That she had a dial phone.
Oh, because all the cool kids had
all buttons. The cool kids could make the beep. They were talking about making songs over the phone. Yeah. And I was thinking, all my family members had touch tone phones by 1980, I think.
No, well, our house had had a giant orange wall phone in the kitchen that had a dial. And it was still there when we left that house in 1990. And it was great. I mean, there were still very few things where you needed to make a tone in order to go to the next menu or something like that. You could still use a dial phone to do almost anything.
In 1970, the first experimental mouse has a button, as mice usually do today. 1984, the Macintosh was the first consumer interface that would let you use a virtual button. You know, I think it was Xerox that came up with the first graphical user interface, but, you know, Mac users were the first to see, oh, this looks like a panel and I'll press this thing that looks like a button and that will make the action take
place.
With
a cursor.
Right. Yeah. Your finger is now a cursor controlled by a mouse. About 10 years ago, I may have said this on Omnibus before, Domino's Pizza hired me to do an ad for a...
As a freelancer?
No, I'm appearing in the ad.
Put you in the ad.
Yeah, I'm the spokesperson for the Domino's Pizza button.
I can't wait to go on the Futurelings site and see people have found this and put it up there.
I don't think it ever aired. I got paid the full amount for an ad that never aired.
The best.
They were going to put pizza buttons in your house where, you know...
No, they were not.
Instead of picking up the phone to call your local Domino's and tell them you want your usual medium pepperoni mushroom, you would just press a button that says Domino's, and that would be on your Wi-Fi, and that would place the order. And this is a real thing, right? I don't know if
like an actual button, a tactile button, not one on your computer.
It looks like a game show button, and I think that's why they hired me. You know,
oh yeah.
But I think
cats kept stepping on it, and pizzas kept coming in the middle of the night.
Cats are eating your pizzas. The raccoons figure out how to do it. It's anarchy. But Amazon did come up with this, right? A dash button that you can put in your, you know, you can. I was always very skeptical. I don't know if these things took off. Like you put one in your laundry room, and then when you're out of detergent, instead of going to your phone and saying, okay, send me detergent, you just hit a button on the wall like it's Star Trek, like it's 1881 when you're James Garfield pressing the button on the Oval Office desk or LBJ getting his Fresca.
Well, it's funny because the phones now, obviously they figured out that what you want to do is get people to be on your phone more, not less.
Yeah. Instead of interacting with the real world.
Yeah. And so at the time it was so... navigating all those places, I mean, it's still awful, but to figure out how to get over to the, so lame, but very quickly, it's like now you don't want a special button. You want any excuse to pick up your phone because then you can order some detergent and then maybe buy some other stuff and play solitaire. Right.
And also life is too complex, you know, like in 1890, maybe all the electrical tasks you needed to do, you could do with, you know, three buttons. You need one to call the servant, one to turn off the light, and one to, you know, set your alarm clock or turn on the burglar alarm or whatever it is. And now, you know, there's tens of thousands of things you might need to do from your home.
Right.
And the phone is the right. So it is the Star Trek future where Captain Kirk's got that iPad thing that he's always looking at and signing or whatever.
But no
buttons on the walls.
Every app is a button.
It's true.
Right? When you have your home screen,
mm-hmm.
it's just, they're all buttons.
And then within the app, there are more buttons, but without the satisfying, I did it, ka-chunk, I changed the machine.
I did it. I do'd it.
Maybe that's generational. Maybe even without haptic feedback, maybe Gen Z feels that same buttony happiness every time they click a go button.
Well, that's the thing. You just said click, an onomatopoeia for... Yeah,
it's not a click.
A sound that doesn't
touch.
Exist.
Sorry, they touch.
They touch.
Touching's just not... Here's what I learned from my lazy boy. Touching is not as good.
But emotionally, touching is very important for a healthy relationship.
You got to touch the aliens.
Mm-hmm. You got to touch your significant other.
You got to touch the raccoon, the blind raccoon.
But you know, we still say, God, it really pushes my buttons.
Yeah, what do you think they said before?
Gosh, it really...
Is that why yanks my chain is a thing?
I guess. Oh, stop yanking my chain, because that was the original potty. And I'd only say potty because it drives my daughter crazy. That was the original way to flush a toilet, was pull a chain.
She's really yanking my chain.
Or probably start a machine. Yank a chain.
Do you think that means, boy, he's really pushing my buttons. That's going to go... It's going to be like, he's really touching my touch screen.
Well, I don't know... Probably before yanking chains, nobody even, emotions were a thought technology that didn't exist yet. So nobody.
Are you saying irritation did not exist until someone thought of buttons?
But there wasn't like a, you wouldn't think of irritation as being a thing that was happening inside of you, right? This person.
Yeah, you don't imagine your soul as being full of buttons that react to stimuli.
Right. If somebody was ignoring you, it was because they were acting wrong, not because you had some, you know, reaction to it. And then
that's very bad.
Somehow yanking a chain must have been, because what you're doing is you're putting yourself in the place of the machine. I'm being turned on in the wrong way. I'm being activated by someone else pushing a button.
Yeah.
And so now I'm the automaton, or I'm the thing that's being operated. And that has to have been a post-industrial.
But that's healthier. That's like Greek Stoicism, like my emotions are the problem here, not the outside world acting on me.
And I think that's what's going away, because now we say you're triggered, which means you're the weapon.
I didn't have any choice in it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's one step beyond having my buttons pushed, right. I guess.
And I wonder what is going to come after being triggered, because that already feels like it's on the way out. So what's next? My app is being opened. Stop opening my apps. And that concludes the push button, entry 1012.DE0611. Certificate number 42007 in the omnibus. Futureling's social media was a non-button dependent cultural evolution, and that's probably what's wrong with it.
Well, Facebook had, you know,
clicking
the like button.
Yeah, that's true. Still facsimiles of buttons. Well, maybe the next thing, the next form, our final form, will be something where either all the buttons are gone or we return to buttons. And I'm going to make a protest sign that says return to buttons. And I'm going to carry it at every protest. It's going to be one of those sort of non sequiturs. There's always someone at a protest now with a comedy sign.
Yes.
I was at the
comedy signs are going to outnumber the real signs at some point.
I was at the, I think I posted a picture, the gay pride parade last year. There was somebody with a sign that said, I'm against mall goths or something like that. And I was like, you're like, stop the mall goths. What are they doing?
Is this an important part of the LGBT movement?
I mean, when I go to the mall, the number of like goths, it's a very small subset of who's at the mall.
That's because you stay away from Hot Topic.
Well, no, actually, I took my daughter into Hot Topic because she was like, I think I'm a dark girl. And I was like, okay, let's explore this. Like, what kind of dark girl? And she was like, I'm not sure, but I know that I'm some kind of dark girl.
That's the first step.
And so I was like, all right, well, let's go to Hot Topic and see if there's a thing at Hot Topic that inspires you. So we went and we walked around Hot Topic, and she looked at all the Funkos.
Yeah, but Hot Topic is also full of Totoros, you know? It's
yeah, right.
Not a lot of true darkness in there.
Well, but there's, you know, there's the punk rock plaid miniskirt with the safety pins.
Sure.
There's the, you know, lace gloves or whatever. And
Tim Burton Corpse Bride.
Yeah, she spent some time in the Hot Topic, and then she walked over to me and was like, I'm not this kind of dark girl. And I said, there's like 9 kinds of dark girl in here. And she was like, I'm none of these. And I was like, all right, well, let's get out of Hot Topic. So we're still exploring. I mean, basically what it means now is that she just wears dark purple. And I'm like, that's a kind of dark girl, I guess, but it's not a mall goth, something else.
Is there a skateboard store she needs to go to?
She's not interested in that. And I think I started early on that. Listen, I don't care who you end up spending your time with, but no skaters and no bass players.
That's the rule.
Yeah. You can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, although who knows for how long. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Looks like you've got a little stack of mail over there.
Yeah, Monica sent us this fun letter she folded together from a weird Butchart Gardens envelope that you... Is this a thing? The postcard you make yourself by folding the poster into an envelope?
I don't know. I like it, though.
I do like it.
It's charming.
Is this Canadian tech that has not made it down to us?
When was the last time you went to Butchart Gardens?
Butchart? That can't be right.
How does it spell?
Well, I think people often think it's Bouchard, like it's French. But I think it's just like Butchart.
Butchart.
Or something like that.
It's by Victoria.
It is.
Yeah.
It's just outside Victoria.
We were there not long ago. Well, now I say not long ago, but actually it was a long time ago, the last time I was there.
We have meant to go to Victoria for probably over a decade. If you mean to go to Victoria for 20 years, is that the same as going to Victoria?
Victoria is charming, but it is... It is presented as much more charming than it is, because if you get behind the facade of Victoria, it's just like a Canadian town that really is sort of just a town.
A little sleepy.
But if you go, you know, there is a great, or there was a great Militaria store that it could only be in Canada, where it's got a bunch of Mountie stuff and World War One medals and all this stuff that it's just like, these don't exist in America anymore.
Canada is a very World War One based culture
so
to this day.
So much. They really made the ultimate sacrifice.
So many of them. Monica says, I wrote on this very strange envelope to note, she enjoyed the Warren Miller episode, but here's what her daughter said during it. Why are we still on the same episode, but now they're talking about Cheez-Its versus Goldfish? That's a very that's a very on target omnibus critique, actually.
Extremely well, you know, half tailed raccoons are a modern plague.
Why are we on the same episode? But they're talking about half tailed raccoons, and then
did the daughter feel like we should have done a Cheez-Its versus Goldfish episode?
I think the implication might be we shouldn't have talked about it at all. We should have continued talking about Warren Miller. and at the moment where we have nothing more to say about Warren Miller, instead of switching to Cheez-Its,
we end the show. But the thing is, we still had stuff to talk about Warren Miller. We just needed to talk about Cheez-Its.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
We need somebody with an electroshock button watching us. Our friend Tom from Queens sent us, a belated holiday gift, probably because I didn't get the mail in time. John, thanks for all the wisdom.
Sure.
We've talked about this. Glad I could help. You know, every time you mention Welsh rare bit on the show, I think it's come up once before that that was a comedy trope of the early 20th century, that this was a very bad food for the stomach, that you would get nightmares if you ate cheese toast.
Yes.
Americans were terrified of light switches and cheese toast.
Cheese toast.
And he actually sent a compilation of the Winsor McCay comic that had this premise called Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend.
There's a whole book just about how Welsh rarebit will give you nightmares.
There was a weekly comic, maybe daily at some point. It's the guy who drew Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Yeah.
And this was slightly less, a slightly less Rococo strip, but it would always be somebody in some incredible surreal situation, absurd situation that would end with him waking up realizing, boy, I got to stop eating rarebit before I go to bed.
Oh, I get it. Sure. This is that's a wonderful comedic premise.
He's getting nightmares from all the cheese toast he ate. So here's your new book of turn of the century Winsor McCay comics.
Done.
Thank you, Tom.
Well done. The only other thing I would add, Ken, is that you can help support the show, which we heartily encourage you to do. But it is not just that you become a benefactor of the show. You also receive what is now an incredible wealth of additional content.
You kind of make us the benefactors of all the amazing stuff we're going to grant you.
This is one of those things like Amanda Palmer's GoFundMe, where it seems like Amanda Palmer raised a bunch of money, but in fact, she promised so many benefits to her patrons.
That she is now living on the street.
She's a mall goth girl. That's right.
She's wandering the mall.
She made $200,000, but it actually cost her $300,000 to fulfill all the promises. And that is true. If you donate to Omnimus, basically we're giving you a treasure trove of additional material for the low, low price of, let's say $15 a month, but you could also get it for $5 a month.
We have never been savvy enough to actually figure out how to make this show profitable. Why start now?
That's right. But you can help us continue to be excited about our prospects and to feel like we are growing a media property that will one day take over the world.
We will tuck our thumbs under our suspenders,
yes,
in the manner of confident American newsboys.
I will chew on the stalk of a little piece of wheat, and we will feel accomplished and good about ourselves. And that is all it requires of you is that you go to patreon.com/omnibus and make the ultimate sacrifice,
like so many of our Canadian boys did in Belgium.
That's right. Make a donation that comports with your ability to give. This is the Marxist part. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And it seems like we don't have as much need, but if you have the ability.
Think about John's jacuzzi tub and how it only does half of the kinds of bubbles it used to do.
Also, I need extensive mouth reconstruction surgery from all the fist fights I got into in my late teens, early 20s.
We did this whole show. We've done almost 600 episodes of this show in hopes of rebuilding your mouth.
Somebody wrote me the other day, a friend wrote and said, how many times have you been in handcuffs? And I did the math and I thought about it and I was like, I have been in handcuffs in the back of a police car 6 times. I have been fully booked and processed, fingerprinted and put into jail 2 times. And never once did I really experience any claustrophobia because it all felt like, well, this is the American judicial process. And so the friend wrote back and said, was this all back when you were drinking and doing drugs? And I said, no, not necessarily. I've been in handcuffs.
One would think.
3 times since I stopped doing drugs. That all costs money.
Are you implying that you're some kind of a freedom fighter and that's why Patreon supporters should open their wallets?
Until I was in my late 40s, I think I was still a freedom fighter. And now I'm just another house-owning boomer who's just part of the problem, not part of the solution.
We need like Yola Tango to do a like a fundraiser song called Let's Save John Roderick's Mouth.
I don't think there's anything that you won't find a way to hopefully involve Yola Tango.
It's true.
You think about them so much.
Everything's better. What do you think Ira and George are doing right now? Let's think about it. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, the push of the button, the proverbial civilization-ending button, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omelette.